Welcome to Functional Medicine Foundations podcast, where we explore root cause medicine, engage in conversation with functional and integrative medicine experts, and build community with like-minded health seekers. I'm your host, Amber Warren. Let's dig deeper. Hi, everyone. Welcome back. So this is kind of, we didn't mean to have a part two, but we had so much good information to share in part one that this is kind of our part two on gut health. And I'm here again with Gavin Gard, and we're going to spend a little bit of time just digging into some of the treatment modalities and the protocols and just some things that both of us really see working for gut health in our clinic. So Gavin, I think I want to start with, well, maybe we should really start with nutrition, because I don't think, you know, I kind of mentioned at the end of the last episode, we can't really talk about gut health without spending at least a little bit of time talking about nutrition and just the impact that makes on gut health in general. So what are some of your recommendations for things like, you know, the things that we talked about, IBS, leaky gut? What are you doing? What are you recommending?
Yeah. Round two. Let's go.
Okay, here we go.
So as I mentioned, the part one, the functional medicine is a diet and lifestyle focused approach. And then we layer on gut health on top of that. So speaking to that foundational diet aspect, we always follow a model of least restrictive to most restrictive dietary a sequence, if you will. So we do not start with for most people, a very restrictive diet right out of the get-gate if they are following a totally cruddy diet, right?
Yeah.
We start to make fine-tune adjustments, starting something with like an ancestral dietary template, kicking out more of those inflammatory, immunogenic, or immune system stimulating foods such as dairy, gluten, soy products, to name a few. That ancestral diet also encompasses foods that are more nutrient dense as compared to the things that are just high calorie but nutrient deplete.
Right.
So that is like the most least restrictive change that we can make, starting with something like an ancestral dietary template.
When you say ancestral, I'm thinking paleo.
Yes, I intentionally didn't use that word.
I figured you didn't.
Because I tell a patient, I'm like, I'm sure you've heard of the paleo diet.
Yeah.
I think when a lot of people hear a common diet term, they kind of get turned off. Some do.
Yeah.
They get turned off because they may have heard on XYZ, newspaper or blog that the paleo diet is associated with, you know, whatever, right?
Yeah.
There's some connotations that people think of. So I use the word ancestral, just, you know, trying to eat things that we were designed to eat, really. That's the kind of the overall encompassing theme of something like that. And our nutritionists, they're absolutely phenomenal in helping people make those practical changes. Because what I tell people, I'm like, on the day-to-day changes that you need to make here, I like to have you spend some time, you know, sitting down with Lexi or one of our other nutritionists to actually talk about how we can close the gap between what you're doing and what we need you to be doing here.
Yeah.
And I always tell them, you know, from my standpoint, I don't need you to be 100%. I want you to be like 80-ish% consistent with this. And the reason that is, a lot of times with people with GI issues, some of them are already fearful of some foods. And we see that in some of the studies, those with irritable bowel syndrome, 13% have severe food restrictive behaviors. Same thing with inflammatory bowel disease. So I do not want to perpetuate that behavior even further. So, you know, we have them get a lot of times with their nutritionist to kind of walk through the practical steps to make these changes. That's the kind of like the least restrictive thing that we could do there. Then we can move up to something like a low FODMAP diet. Mm-hmm. I say that term and a lot of patients are like, what did you say?
Yeah.
So FODMAP stands for fermentable oligo, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols. It's a fancy term for fermentable fiber in your diet.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of us are told to eat foods like avocados, a lot of these cruciferous veggies like broccoli, cauliflower, a lot of the allium vegetables, onions, garlic. Great foods, right? I don't have a beef with them. I think they're absolutely fine. But some of these healthy foods that we are told to eat, in some individuals, there's an intolerance to them. There's a FODMAP intolerance to them. And that can present as more gas, more bloating, loose stools, constipation. So we start to avoid or moderate, restrict those foods, and we often get benefit. And it's not just me saying this. There are plenty of studies in those with irritable bowel syndrome that show on average about a 70% response rate to a low FODMAP diet, meaning that, you know, you take a group of 100 people with IBS, you give them all a low FODMAP diet, 70% of them will improve. Mm-hmm. Now, there's 30% that don't, but in the realm of gut health, especially IBS, that is a phenomenal treatment response.
Yeah.
It's phenomenal. I mean, even these FDA-approved medications, rifaximin, for example, costs some patients $1,200 to get. That is like a 45 to 50% response rate. So again, diet, lifestyle, focus, a low FODMAP diet is an informed treatment modality that's a little bit more restrictive. Now, I always tell patients, I say, this is not lifelong. We are not doing this forever.
Right.
My two goals are, one, to get you to the broadest diet possible while still maintaining symptom improvement.
Yep.
That's not to say we are going out to Chick-fil-A every day, but we are still maintaining some nutrient or nutrition pillars, but you're not fearful of eating certain foods, right? Yeah. So I'm not having them follow a low FODMAP diet long-term. I have them reintroduce some things. And then number two is, I want you on the minimal effective dose of any supplements, any medications that you need, so that you're not dependent on 20 different things that get you to maintain those improvements. So really, this is a short-term kind of extra push that we use in conjunction with all these diet and lifestyle changes that we're making. So we have this ancestral dietary template. We have low FODMAP template. We're trying to, you know, expand the diet as much as possible. We get them help with our amazing nutritionists. There's some other fancy diets out there, the specific carbohydrate diet. There's some other diets out there that I won't touch on too much because, quite frankly, I don't use them as much. If I need to go that restrictive with someone, I'm probably missing something.
I use the elimination diet a lot in my practice to kind of kickstart gut health and kickstart honing in on what foods an individual patient might be reacting to. Are you using that a lot in your practice?
Not as much. I usually use kind of an empirical, you know, something like ancestral, low FODMAP, sometimes something called like a low histamine diet.
Yep.
I think that's a great starting point. I feel like it's a great experiment that everyone should go through, even if it's, you know, somewhat restrictive. It's only short term, and you could really gather some important and vital data from that of how your body responds to specific foods that you may not get from an empiric trial of like ancestral or low FODMAP diet.
And intentionally pulling out foods to get rid of the antibodies, your body's reacting to those foods, and then reintroducing in a very specific way.
Absolutely.
To assess your response. Mm-hmm. And again, it might not be, oh, my bloating went away, and then when I reintroduced gluten, my bloating came back. It might be, we talked about this in the first episode, it might be brain fog. Mm-hmm. It might be joint pain.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be these gastrointestinal symptoms that we see.
Yeah.
Good stuff. You have really helped educate us as practitioners on this topic along the lines of an elemental diet. Mm. And your response, some of the anecdotal results you're getting are unbelievable with this elemental diet. Let's talk about that and how you implement that.
Yeah. An elemental diet is not necessarily another set of rules or restrictions that you follow. It's not the typical diet in that diet sense. What it is more so is a meal replacement strategy. Mm-hmm. An elemental diet is preformed powder, if you will, that has all the vital calories, protein, carbohydrates, vitamins, minerals that you need to sustain
a
healthy diet.
It's not a protein powder. We're not talking protein.
A protein powder. No, it's a prescription grade pre-digested protein and carbohydrates that, you know, you mix in with water, kind of like a protein powder, but it's not.
Yeah.
So it's special, right?
Yeah.
So it's pre-digested protein and carbohydrates into their most elemental form, hence the name elemental diet.
Yep.
Why would you do that? Well, think of it this way. If you were to go out and run a mile and you sprain your ankle, what would you do? You would rest, right? In the same way, when our gut is unhappy, it's in a disease state or a dysfunctional state, we should not ask it to continue to work hard for us. We shouldn't be putting this influx of foods that it may be sensitive to, that has to work hard to digest, absorb, assimilate. So we need to give it a break.
Yeah.
We got to give it some time to go to the Bahamas and have a nice time on the beach, if you will. Just like a nice respite. So how do we do that without driving ourselves crazy of having to fast? Because really the fasting would be the only way that we would do that. We have a lot of people say inflammatory bowel disease. Can't ask them to fast forever. They got to have some calories. And that's really the genesis of how the elemental diet started to get incorporated into clinical practice, was looking at inflammatory bowel disease patients. So it's this prescription grade meal replacement of pre-digested protein and carbohydrates. It's all absorbed in that first 2 feet of your small intestine. Mm-hmm. Thus, it gives the rest of your gut a nice little time to chill out and relax, repair itself. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, and maybe we could talk about a little bit the studies behind it. So again, it kind of came out of the inflammatory bowel disease research. For example, there was a group of 150 IBD patients, and they used this elemental diet as like their sole source of calories for 4 weeks or a month. And I know that may sound a little intense daunting, but remember, these are people who are severely malnourished. Yeah. They can't eat anything without having severe symptoms. At baseline, 91% of them had some type of malnourishment. They were not doing well. Yeah. They used this elemental diet for 4 weeks. Not only did they see an improvement in their symptom severity, they saw an improvement in their quality of life, their number of bowel habits. They also saw malnourishment rates drop from 91% to 21%, a delta of 70% reduction. Wow. Absolutely, from just malnourishment, from this elemental diet.
Yeah.
So it leads to symptom improvement, improvement quality of life, reduced malnourishment, again, because our gut's epicenter for nutrient absorption. Mm-hmm. There have also been some studies to show benefit in SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, and irritable bowel syndrome, as well as some joint issues and some autoimmune conditions. We see in one study in those with rheumatoid arthritis, this autoimmune joint disease, that an elemental diet was as effective as oral steroids in improving symptoms, quality of life.
And you don't have to do that for 4 weeks.
You don't have to do it for 4 weeks. There's different ways that we can use this. We can use this just as like a meal replacement for maybe one or two meals of the day. The other meals are following XYZ template. We could use this as like a short reset where we use it for like 2 to 4 days, and then we start to gradually reintroduce some foods after that. I rarely have it used longer than that. Maybe in some of my IBD patients, I'll use it a little bit longer, maybe a week or two, because they're so severely malnourished. But it's a really great tool, and it really works well in conjunction with other GI therapies.
Yeah. Do you see, you know, we know the data on like metabolic issues, or even just, you know, a kind of stubborn weight loss issues. Do you see, you know, the data with that related to gut health? What about people that just almost want like a help pushing that reset button, metabolically speaking?
I think it's a great way to mimic a fast.
Yep.
A lot of us, if you've ever done some type of time-restricted feeding, short fast, maybe a 14, 18-hour fast, a lot of people report just better mental clarity and sharpness, reduced brain fog, and that's because of how our gut affects, you know, chronic inflammation. So I think this is a really good way of still getting in some calories, mimicking that kind of fasting phenomenon. Quite frankly, I use it almost every day because I don't like breakfast. A lot of people just don't like to eat breakfast. I use it every day as a meal replacement.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, I'll be looking at labs in the morning. I'll be sipping on my elemental shake. Cool. I don't chug it. But I'll sip on that, and it's a nice way for busy folks just to get in some food that without having to be fearful of how it may make them go rushing into the bathroom or scare away their partner with gas or anything like that.
Yeah. Okay, cool. I love that. You have introduced this idea called triple probiotic therapy to our clinic that I don't think a lot of us, I can't speak for all our practitioners, but I certainly wasn't implementing with my patients and I since have. Let's go there.
Yeah.
Triple probiotic therapy. Why are you using it? What's the data behind it?
Yeah. So probiotics are live organisms that exert a beneficial effect on the host. That host is us, you know. And that's the definition from the World Health Organization. There's probiotics and there's prebiotics. Prebiotics are totally separate. That's like the fiber. That's the stuff that feeds the organisms that live in our gut. So not only is there that differentiation between pre and post or probiotics, there's four different categories of probiotics that we should be aware of. One of which has the word E. coli in it, and the FDA here in the United States has said, no, thank you. We don't want to have any probiotics with the word E. coli in it. That's E. coli NIS-1917. It's called Mutiflora. It's available in Canada. So that leaves us down to three different probiotic categories. There is a healthy yeast probiotic category. It's called Saccharomyces boulardii. There's a soil-based probiotic, and that is all the Bacillus species. So if you look at the probiotic label, say Bacillus subtilis or Bacillus coagulans, that is bacterial species that are found in the soil. Mm-hmm. Why that's important is because we live in a very hygienic environment. We're not, we don't have our hands in the soil and gardening as much anymore. We're not harvesting as much of our own food. And then the third category, probably the most well-studied category, is the Lactobacillus bifidobacterium blend. And again, there's thousands of studies just showing there's benefit in IBS alone, not to say other GI and non-GI conditions. So there's three different categories. Well, how would we use three different categories? Should we use those, you know, just one in isolation at a time? Well, what we see in two different data points that we see this benefit of using all three is anecdotally, we see a benefit of using three categories of probiotics at the same time as compared to one. And then we see research to show that more broad spectrum probiotics work much better than just one single strain mm-hmm. or one single species. So the way that we've been using this in clinical practice is this novel concept of a triple therapy probiotic stack where you use all three categories of probiotics at the same time. And I've had a lot of patients come to me. They said that maybe they've tried a probiotic from the grocery store. They've tried it for maybe a few weeks. It didn't really make a difference. I will use that as a data point and I'll try to say, you know, hey, Mary Sue, I know that you've tried this one strain in the past. I know it didn't work for you. I'd like us to try this triple probiotic stack. We'll do it for 3 to 4 weeks and reassess your symptom improvement at that time. And I would say many times, we do see people who failed single probiotic therapy respond well, beneficially to this triple probiotic stack. Huh. So I use that quite often, just given the plethora of research to show how probiotics are beneficial. It's beneficial for GI conditions, IBS and SIBO. And you may be wondering, why the heck would you give your gut more bacteria if you have a bacterial overgrowth? Theoretically, that makes total sense. Unfortunately, or I would say fortunately, we have high quality research to show probiotics help with SIBO eradication. Mm-hmm. It helps clear out that SIBO. And the analogy I use is kind of this like the city phenomenon where our gut is like this city. There's a constant race between the good guys and the bad guys, right? If you got a bunch of bad guys coming into the city, like in Seattle, all the good guys are going to leave, right? So there's constant flux. And if we could outcrowd the good guys or outcrowd the bad guys with the good guys, we can clear out any potential bad players.
Again, that concept of dysbiosis we talked about.
Dysbiosis is constant balance and flux of the microorganisms. So probiotics are helpful for IBS, bacterial overgrowth. They actually secrete anti-inflammatory and antibacterial, antifungal properties. So even though they're probiotics, they're somewhat antimicrobial in nature. And so it's helpful for SIBO, IBS. It's helpful for things like allergies, skin conditions. Mm-hmm. It's helpful for mood, sleep, some hormones, which I'm sure we'll talk about later on, anxiety, depression, brain fog. So kind of widespread effects there.
So cool. One of my favorite uses for this, the one of the three that you talked about, Saccharomyces boulardii, two uses actually. So helpful for diarrhea, even acute onset of diarrhea, right? Like almost like a viral GI issue. And then it's a really gentle mold binder. Mm-hmm. So a lot of my patients that come in, you know, they're still trying to remediate their home. We think there's mold on board. You start Saccharomyces boulardii and it can help the gut health, but also help start to bind up mold in the body.
Yeah. And it doesn't make sense. Why would you give your body fungus, more or less, when you may have mold colonization, again, because a lot of these probiotics have antibacterial properties to them.
Yeah.
And that's where, you know, we have really nice, well-designed clinical, randomized clinical studies showing benefit, and that trumps any theoretical or mechanistic thinking.
Absolutely. So if we believe in that data, kind of the city analogy that you were talking about, which I explain it very similarly to that, we just have to repopulate the good to crowd out the bad. Where's the use, or where do you start to bring in some of these antimicrobials, right? Like herbal antibiotics, if you will, to help somebody kill the bad guys or help someone with gut health.
Yeah, like where in the process?
Yes,
yeah.
In your treatment.
So there's kind of divvy that up. There's prescriptive or pharmaceutical antibiotics. We've talked about rifaximin. It's a non-absorbed antibiotic. I mean, it doesn't have some of the downstream detrimental effects that some of these antibiotics do. There's rifaximin. That's really expensive for a lot of people. If it's not covered by insurance, up to $1,200 for like a two-week supply. Yeah. There's things like neomycin as an adjunct to that. And then we have herbal antibiotics. And again, these are natural agents that not only have antibacterial properties, but antifungal, antiparasitic, antiviral. And we show that in the case of SIBO, for example, that they have pretty equivalent efficacy to things like this prescriptive rifaximin that's FDA approved. So this is things like oil of oregano and berberine and some garlic. And we use, how I usually use them at least, is through this kind of low dose of kind of a more broad spectrum blend of them. And I use it a little bit longer. So instead of the antibiotic being like the atomic bomb on the microbiome, you know, usually a 5-7 day course, it just completely eradicates things. Think of if you had like this kind of a bush or a hedge in front of your house that, you know, normally our microbiome is kept to an appropriate concentration. It's when that hedge or that bush starts to become overgrown. Now it's covering the windows and it's just crowding out all the good plants. That's when it starts to drop your real estate value. In the same way, when our microbiome starts to become overgrown, dysbiosis or bacterial overgrowth, we've got to trim that. I find that using more low dose, longer term of things like herbal antimicrobials usually work better because they're gentler on the system. They're usually better well tolerated and they have more of this broad spectrum effect. I usually don't start with this, and here's why. We have more research to show diet, lifestyle changes, probiotics, just the quantity of research shows more benefit as compared to the few studies that we have with like rifaximin and antimicrobials. So I usually start with things like diet, lifestyle, probiotics. And we also see, again, probiotics have antibacterial properties, and multiple data points show that probiotics, when administered with antibiotics, improves the eradication rate of antibiotics. We see this time and time again with something
Wait, say that again.
Yeah, so when you administer, we'll take studies. Someone who has maybe SIBO, or maybe someone who has like a bacterial growth like H. pylori. We administer antibiotics. And then we'll take another group, the same people, but we'll give them antibiotics plus probiotics to see if there's a greater benefit. And this is placebo controlled, right? So we're kind of ruling that out. It's the people that we give probiotics on top of the antibiotics that we see higher eradication rate of that bacteria that shouldn't be there. In other words, there's a greater efficacy of that antibiotic when you give probiotics along with that. Not only that, we see that there's a lower side effect profile of the antibiotics. That, you know, you're always looking for diarrhea. That's a common antibiotic induced side effect that you get, and probiotics can mitigate or blunt that side effect profile. So I like to use them together if we can because of some of the studies showing benefit there, reduction in side effects, and it usually just works a whole heck of a lot better.
What do you say to your patients? I get this a lot. That the research on probiotics, that sounds great and all, Amber, but I really want to try and get these beneficial bacteria from food.
So you're talking about probiotics from food?
Fermented foods, pre and probiotic foods.
That's certainly an option, and something that one could start with if their symptoms are mild in nature, or something that we could use more of a maintenance plan to extend those benefits that we would get from supplemental probiotics. A few different points here that I would want to bring up is one is the dose, right? The dose that we use for something like a category 3 probiotic, that lactobacillus bifidobacterium, and we sometimes I'll use 50 to 100 billion, what are called CFUs or colony forming units of that per day. Try to get that from kimchi or sauerkraut or kefir. Some of the foods that have higher probiotics, you're looking at eating like 20 cups of kimchi per day. That's not going to be fun nor practical. So for just from a dose perspective, probiotics can help with or on top of the diet changes that we make.
There's synergistic effects there.
Synergistic, and we're just going to get more of a, you know, a therapeutic, a clinically effective dose there. The other point is some of these probiotic-containing foods also have things that may be detrimental to mm-hmm. your gut health and that one would have to account for when deciding, do I use this or do I not? For example, like we talked about, some people are FODMAP intolerant. They're intolerant.
Right.
They get these side effects or symptoms from these fibrous foods like sauerkraut.
Yeah.
Right? Sauerkraut has a bunch of probiotics, but also has a bunch of cabbage.
Yeah.
And people with IBS, a lot of them do not do well with more fiber. I just had a patient this week. She had diagnosed IBS for 30 years.
Oh my goodness.
30 years. She was told as she was constipated.
Yeah.
We told her, and people were telling her, eat more fiber, and here's a fiber supplement. So she was eating like all the broccoli, all the cauliflower in the world, fiber supplement. I noted that she had a bunch of gas and bloating, and she's been taking these things for a long time. I simply had her, the first point, I just said, hey, let's go on a low FODMAP diet. Let's stop the fiber. And 4 weeks later, her symptoms like 90% improved.
Wow.
30 years just by reducing fiber.
And she's not constipated.
Not constipated.
Her bowels are still moving.
Yeah, that's the thing with fiber. And that's another discussion, but fiber is not as great for constipation as we would hope for. Or we would think. And some people it does well, some people it doesn't. There's some things I would look for to see if that's the case or not. Some of these foods are higher fiber. People do not do well with them. Mm-hmm. They're also higher in some histamine, which is another element of what gets built up in the food when it gets fermented. You know, wine, chocolate, a lot of these fermented foods, kimchi, sauerkraut, kefir. I ask people, how often are you eating that? A lot of people say, not enough. I'm like, well, no, I'm actually looking if this could be too much.
Yeah.
Because sometimes that could lead to the diarrhea, the abdominal discomfort, the bloating, the fatigue. So I would say if you can get it from your diet, but just be mindful of those things. And to really get a clinically effective dose, you likely need a supplement with it.
Yeah. Okay, good. That's a great response. You use a lot of what are called IgG immunoglobulins in your mm-hmm. practice to heal leaky gut, kind of this concept of this increased intestinal permeability. How do those work? Why are you implementing a lot of that in your treatment protocols?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure if we know exactly how it works.
Yeah,
there's some theories out there. So what are immunoglobulins? Well, like I've talked about before, hinted to, our immune system secretes things called antibodies. Mm-hmm. And that normally attacks things that shouldn't be there. Infections, for example, it kind of gloms on to it and then it tags it for destruction or it just destroys it right then and there. Now, we can use these things called immunoglobulins, which are more or less preformed antibodies. One of the hallmark causes or etiologies, one of the, what is the cause? What's going on here with IBS, for example, is immune system dysfunction. There may be an autoimmune component. It just could be because our immune system's kind of going haywire,
yeah.
right? There's some type of shift going on here.
Yeah.
And that's where immunoglobulins really come into play after we've corrected for things like dysbiosis, or maybe if someone's still having symptoms, it's an immune system issue.
Yeah.
And so we use these immunoglobulins. And the analogy I give to people is, imagine if you were to ingest these glass shards, these fine glass shards, you ingest them, it totally just wreck your gut, right? It'd be very harmful to our gut. That could be what's going on when you have a bunch of these bacterial toxins mm-hmm. that is produced inside you, this bacterial imbalance that's producing toxins like lipopolysaccharides, mm-hmm. for example, that go in, they stimulate your immune system, they directly damage the gut barrier. Now, what if we were to dip those glass shards in something like wax, cool it, mm-hmm. right? So we're kind of adding this protective coating or layering on top of it. Then we ingest it. It's going to make those toxins, those glass shards, less detrimental.
Yeah.
That's exactly what we're doing with immunoglobulins.
Yep.
So there, Dr. Weinstock is a GI doc, has kind of pioneered this work in immunoglobulins. It was once a pharmaceutical, super expensive, has now since become over the counter. You're looking for like Immunolin, IgG, immunoglobulins as an example there. And he's shown some really nice benefit in IBS. People who've used a bunch of therapies for irritable bowel syndrome, pharmaceutical, diet, supplemental, they had not seen any benefit. So these are refractory patients. Patients are really frustrated because they've tried all these things, still hasn't seen any benefit. They added immunoglobulins onto their treatment plan, and what they saw was about a 70% response rate. Pretty phenomenal in these people who were not responding to anything before. So I really use this when I'm considering, okay, maybe this is the immune system.
Right.
Maybe this isn't necessarily inflammatory or a diet mismatch or they're just stressed out. Maybe this is immune system dysfunction going on. The immunoglobulins have been super helpful in that.
Yeah, that's good. Good. So triple probiotic therapy, elemental diets, IgG immunoglobulins. What else are you seeing make really good headway for patients?
Yeah, I mean, there's... Why I like GI care is that there's so many different therapies.
And protocols.
And not even protocols. I mean, just like different ways you can layer in all these therapies. And it's usually not just one. Sometimes you hit it right off the bat, like, yeah, you got celiac disease. That was never diagnosed. Go gluten-free.
And then you're the hero.
Yeah. I mean, even then, a lot of gluten celiac disease patients go gluten-free, still have symptoms. Mm-hmm. That's a whole nother discussion. Yeah. So we have a lot of different therapies here. We have enzyme support. We've talked about exocrine pancreatic insufficiency. They need enzyme replacement. People who just feel super bloated, mm-hmm. Maybe they're older, have some other autoimmune condition. That makes me think that they have an insufficiency of hydrochloric acid mm-hmm. enzyme production. So we give them broad spectrum enzymes, hydrochloric acid replacement. Mm-hmm. We see things like prokinetics, breaking that word down. So pro to foster and then kinetic movement. So we're trying to foster healthy movement of the gut. Again, pharmaceutical supplement options here. There's fiber. We've talked about maybe that's not so great with constipation. Sometimes it is needed and it could actually be helpful for diarrhea too. Mm-hmm. Even though some people don't do well with fiber, some people do need it. So I know that maybe that sounds contradictory, but again, it's just you needing to get with a good practitioner that understands everything about your case, really get all these data points to make informed treatment decisions.
What's your thought on using a bunch of magnesium citrate for constipation?
Yeah, it works absolutely wonderful for a lot of people. It's an osmotic laxative. So what that means is it draws water in the large intestine into the inner lumen or the inner part of the intestine to help with a healthy stool frequency and consistency. It's dirt cheap. Yeah. There's really no side effect.
So safe, yeah.
I mean, other than diarrhea and going overboard, of course. But that's a really great therapy too.
Get it going. Yeah. Awesome. So many good just approaches and what works, what doesn't, what's working within your practice. You answered wonderfully last time I asked this question at the end of each one of my interviews. I like to say, hey, Gavin, what's the, if you had to say one piece of advice that may or may not relate to specifically what we just talked about that moves the needle the most for your patients, you just see the best outcomes. What would that be in this case?
Yeah, I mean, apart from just GI-specific care, I think people just have to get used to do hard things. I think we've, as a society, we have become weak. Yeah. We've become too comfortable. Yeah. I mean, I feel a little guilty saying that now in this, you know, climate-controlled room in this comfy chair.
I know.
But we have become way too comfortable. We don't have that climate change. We're not used to cold and heat exposures anymore. A lot of us have become sedentary. We're not exercising and pushing our body to its limits. We're not used to not having a constant slow drip of food. We're not used to the fasting exercise.
Hunger cues.
Yeah, hunger. Like we as a species, we used to be hungry a lot of the time. We were exposed to cold, we were exposed to hot, we did hard things. I think unfortunately now we've become too comfortable. So I think if one could think about and truly, you know, reflect on this, what are some things that you can implement that can challenge you? And I think, you know, unfortunately now we're becoming so challenged just like with stress. Mm-hmm. And that's, we just, and there's a mismatch there. We're putting too much stress on our body than what we're able to handle. On the other end of the spectrum, a lot of us have just become too comfortable. I watched this series, Limitless, with Chris Hemsworth, where he goes and does all these challenges of like heat and cold therapy and a lot of these, you know, exercise and strength feats. And it was kind of interesting to get me thinking about like, okay, these are things that as a species we should be doing to this day to really, I mean, it just changes your framework of one of fragility to one of resilience. And I think the more and more you do it, you start to be thankful for the body that God blessed us with. I mean, really, we're designed to do some incredible things. And I think we ought to express that more often.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that concept of stress isn't inherently a bad thing. It's when you're not building resiliency to that stress or deactivating the nervous system and that stress isn't going away, you're not mm-hmm. building in that rest, that's when it becomes a bad thing.
Absolutely.
Right? We have to be resilient to stressors.
Yeah.
I love that idea of, the cold therapy, cold showers, cold plunges. That's one way that you can
things you could do there,
oh
too.
Oh, my gosh, and what that does for mental toughness. I mean, let's do a whole podcast on just how you increase that resiliency and do the hard things to train your body and then, you know, breaking down mechanistically how that benefits the body with upregulating detoxification and balancing cortisol. And I mean, there's so much to unpack there.
Yeah, there's a great book if people want to kind of get dabbling into this. I think it's called Wedge by Scott Carney.
Cool.
Where he talks about some of these ancestral stressors and how they can help us become more resilient. So I'd encourage you to give it a try. I started doing more sauna therapy while I'm here.
Sauna's great.
I think it's, you know, you look at some of the studies out of the Nordic countries where everyone has a sauna, dry saunas, and, you know, those getting up to 180, 190 degrees. There's also infrared saunas, which are another great option there. We have that or Meridian Clinic.
Yeah.
But there's great studies to show reduction in cardiovascular disease.
Yes.
There's vascular benefits here. There's going to be a lower rate of things like Alzheimer's and dementia. So I've been incorporating that in my, you know, kind of weekly routine.
Cool.
I've been taking some time off exercise, but I think it's been a great stressor to engage in.
Yeah, that's amazing. Oh my goodness. Okay. Well, that's such a great thing to end on. Thank you so much for your time today, Gavin. We'll look forward to having you back on.
Yeah. Thanks, Amber.
Thank you for listening to the Functional Medicine Foundations podcast. For more information on topics covered today, programs offered at FMF, and the highest quality of supplements and more, go to funmedfoundations.com.